part. Going to miss the best part of the whole lesson. Come on in. Let's pray, and then we'll get into it. Lord, thank you for the day. Thank you for this morning and for the opportunity to gather together. I pray that you would, this morning, as we begin to look into Leviticus, that we get beyond just the nuts and bolts of sacrifice, and we would look toward the heart you desire in sacrifice. Lord, I pray that you would help us to recognize your holiness, your purity, and your demands for holiness and purity, and really our inability to get there apart from the sacrifice of your Son. Thank you for just, again, making it clear for us about how we're to approach you, about how we're to respond to you, and not leaving us in the dark, and not leaving us just to guess about how to get it right. I thank you so much for that. Lord, just encourage us through your word this morning. We ask this all in your name. Amen. All right, last week we introduced Leviticus. This week we're going to actually start jumping into the book. So again, this is not going to be like Genesis and Exodus were, where it was more of a verse-by-verse type deal. This is going to be more of an overview, more of a kind of a flyover, but not just in. We're actually going to talk about individual things while we're here, but we're not going to get quite into the detail that we've gotten in the past so far. So this morning we're actually going to look at if you have the notes from last week, and I'm sorry I didn't bring those with me, so just keep up. We're actually on the outline portion, which I call Introduction to Worship 101. Again, this is important for Israel because as they approach Sinai, when they're at the base of Sinai, getting the law from God, they didn't have formal worship yet. They didn't know exactly how to approach God. In fact, they really didn't know him that well yet. He had shown himself to them. He had introduced himself to them when Moses came back and said, I'm going to take you out of here. And they asked, who sent you? And Moses said, Yahweh has sent me. That was the introduction or the reintroduction of this nation to him. But with regarding how to really worship him, how to do sacrifice, the priest system, all of that had not been in place yet. That's going to happen as they walk this year and 2 months they spend at the base of the foot of Sinai. That time period there is when this all gets laid out for them. So that's why there's such detail in all of these commandments, all of these laws, all these spelling out how to sacrifice. So as you're reading it, especially for those of us who no longer do that kind of sacrifice, it seems to get tedious at times. But understand the reason he's so specific is because it hasn't ever happened that way before. Yes, there have been sacrifices. Cain and Abel offered sacrifice. Abraham offered sacrifice. Job offered sacrifice. Isaac offered sacrifice, and Jacob offered sacrifice, but never in this context of sacrifice with the law. This is brand new. This is brand new. And so what he's doing with something brand new is he's laying out all of the details. And what I think is interesting about this is what God does with the law is he lays it all out at first. He doesn't wait for something to happen and then make the law. That's how we do it. Trust me, that's how we do it. The first air traffic control handbook was about 20 pages thick. Now, the air traffic control handbook, the 7110.65, I think it's probably J or K now, is about that thick. So when you're an air traffic controller, you walk in the door and they hand you a book that's that thick. Well, most of the things in that book came because somebody did something wrong. Somebody crashed, somebody didn't say their phraseology quite exactly right, and they said, oh, the lawyers looked at it and said, we got to fix that, so now we got a book like this instead of like this. God's law starts like this. Nothing sneaks up. He doesn't say, oh, didn't plan for that one. That's not what happened. So that's why this, especially the first seven chapters of Leviticus are so detailed because he's laying out every potential, every case, really. And he does that then for each offering that he's going to talk about. He lays out every case. He starts with, you know, like, for instance, when we start with the burnt offering in just a second, he's going to lay out the most costly offering you can give down to the least costly offering you can give. And he's going to give the details for every one of those kinds of offerings, so there's no question about how it's supposed to happen. So that's why this is so detailed. It's not to put you to sleep because we're bored. It's to help Israel know exactly how it is they're supposed to worship. That's what it's all about. So that explains the detail here. So with that being said, let's look at some of the detail. The first major section of Leviticus are the five major offerings. There are five major offerings that happen on a somewhat daily basis. The first three appear to be voluntary. The last two are not. The first one is burnt offering. And it starts off this. He says, the Lord said to Moses, this is chapter 1, verse 1. Speak to the people of Israel and say to them, when any one of you brings an offering to the Lord, you shall bring it from your life, offering your livestock from the herd, from the flock. So he starts off with a when. Now, I'm not a Hebrew scholar, and I'm not the son of a Hebrew scholar, but I know I do read Hebrew scholars. And apparently this when can be taken as an if as well, or if someone. So it's not. This is not a have-to kind of offering. The burnt offering is it's voluntary, at least the way I understand it. And the reading I did showed it as a voluntary offering, which means, and it's important, because if you actually look at this and you consider and go to Numbers and look at when the burnt offering was to be offered, it was to be offered in the morning and the evening of every day. It was to be offered on the first day of every month. It was to be offered on the first day of a feast day. If you took every time that this burnt offering was supposed to be offered, and if this is a mandatory offering, you could have nothing left of everything you're supposed to. So if it's a mandatory offering and you did it on the every day, morning and evening, then of course you'd be doing it on the first day of the month, morning and evening. And of course you'd be doing it on the first day of a feast day, a festival, morning and evening. Of course you would. So there would be redundancy built in, and I don't think that it was, okay, so on the first day of a month, and if the first day of a month happens to be a feast day, you didn't bring three burnt offerings. I don't think it's the case. So this was a voluntary offering, something they could do if they wanted to, but when they wanted to, there was specific instructions for offering this burnt offering, specific instructions for that. So that's the burnt offering. The burnt offering is to symbolize the dedication and devotion of the worshiper to God. That's what it's for. It was an offering that was brought from the worshiper for a heart, and it was just saying to God, I am devoted to, I am dedicated to you. It was brought, there were three ways to bring this offering. You could, first of all, you could bring the offering, if you were wealthy enough and you had the means to do so, you were to bring a bull. Now, it's interesting, it had to be something from your flock or from your herd. So you could not bring, you couldn't go out and catch a deer, you know, and somehow, you know, snare a deer, a live deer, and bring it up and say, well, here, I'm going to offer this as the burnt offering today. No, it couldn't be a wild animal that you brought. You couldn't go out and catch a lion and bring that lion and say, okay, priest, let's see you do this one. No, you couldn't do that. It had to be from your flock or from your herd. It had to be one of those kinds of things, okay? And there are three prescriptions given. There's the from the herd, which is the bull, which is the big deal. There was the flock, which is the goat or sheep, and then there was a bird. You could bring either one of those things for this offering to be accomplished. If you brought a bull, it had to be a male. And for the burnt offering, except for the bird, it doesn't say male or female bird. It just says a bird. But for the bull and for the lamb goat, they have to be male for the burnt offering. So if you had a desire, if you wanted to bring this burnt offering, you would take your, if you had the means to do so, and it wasn't, I don't think it was, this is a voluntary offering from your heart, so it would be, you would know whether or not you had the means to do so, and if you were being stingy, then why make the offering anyway, right? Because if you're symbolizing your devotion and dedication to God, and you had the means to bring a bull, and you bring a bird, you're not really devoted or dedicated to God. So basically, you're lying in your offering. But there's no prescription, like if you have 25 bulls, you have to bring one of your bulls. It's nothing like that. It's on the worshiper to determine what he or she brings. So that's there. But if you brought a bull, again, it had to be a male bull, of course. It had to be. It's hard to get one of them there female bulls. if you figure that one out, let me know. No, there's not. So you bring that, and you would bring it to the entrance to the tabernacle. Interesting. And there it would be killed, and everything would be taken care of. It would be the priest then would take over. They would slit its throat, they would drain its blood, and they would take some of its blood and sprinkle its blood all around the altar. The excess blood then they would actually just pour at the base of the altar. Then they would butcher the animal. They would completely skin the animal. They would take all of its entrails out. They would take, and something else they would do, which is significant, was they would actually wash all of the entrails, and they would wash the legs, especially the hind legs of the animal. That is a symbol, I believe, of purification. It's a symbol of you didn't want to offer excrement with your offering of dedication. I missed a step. Before you did give it to, you would lay your hands on the head of the sacrifice, symbolizing a transference of your position to that sacrifice. Then it would be placed on the altar, and it would be burned completely, except for the skin and for some that would be taken outside the camp and gotten rid of. But the offering was completely burned. There was none of this saved back for the priests. None of this was given. The priests couldn't take any of the burnt offering. It was to be completely consumed because it was supposed to be a sweet aroma to God, representing the dedication of the worshiper to him. So that's the distinction of the burnt offering from the sin offering and from the guilt offering. The priest didn't get any of this offering. It was completely consumed, completely burnt. So that's if you brought a bull. The next section, starting in verse 10, is if it's sheep or goat. And he walks through that. Again, a male without blemish. Yeah, J.D.? Yeah, like one generation into the land. I don't know that Israel ever did a really good job of doing these sacrifices. One generation into the land, when you start the book of Judges, the first generation, it says a generation rose up that did not know God. If you don't know God, how dedicated to God can you really be? That's a problem. By the time God takes them, they fail over and over again, so God takes them into captivity. You'd think after 70 years of captivity, they come back, they get it right, correct? Well, by the time you get to Malachi, they're not bringing the best, they're bringing junk when they're offering. In fact, that's one of their, God says to them, "You have robbed me." And they say, "Wherein have we robbed you?" And he says, "You've robbed me by bringing your lame and your blemished and your spotted." And so they're bringing their junk. Again, And that's not too far after. They hit the land. They get back to the land, dedicated temple 516 B.C. Malachi is written about 430 B.C. So within 100 years, they've already thrown off this kind of worship of God and have gone back to kind of a self-worship. So I would like to say they really did a good job with this, but I don't think they ever really did a good job with this at all. So in Josiah's reign, when Josiah's king, see, this is why we don't ever get any place. Because somebody asked a question, I have to answer it. In Josiah's reign, Josiah is king, and he becomes king at the end of a really bad king's reign. You read Kings and figure it out. And he is a good king, and he wants to see worship reestablished in Israel. So he's doing renovations at the temple. And while they're doing renovations at the temple, they open up a room and they find this scroll, and they look at this scroll, and no one knows what it is, even the priests. They have no idea what this thing is. So Josiah says, "We'll open it up, let's figure out what it is." They open it, figure out it's the law. It's the law. They had no idea even what the law looked like. So I doubt seriously they were really doing much real sacrifice at that point. So long answer, short question, I don't think they ever really did a very good job of this. In fact, it gets so bad even after the captivity that the gifts really stop happening. The offerings stop happening, even the ones that the priest gets part of, because at that point the priests have actually left the priesthood and have gone out and are really supporting themselves. They've gotten themselves their own land. They're raising their own flocks, their crop, because they're not being supported by the gifts of the people. In fact, where they're supposed to have the storerooms for the gifts of the people, they have a Samaritan named Tobiah living in the temple. They've rented out an apartment to him. So, you know, have fun, you know, whatever. So Nehemiah takes care of that. So it's a good question. Any other questions so far? Don't you dare. No, it's okay. If you want to, that's fine. So we had the most expensive or the most costly, which is the bull. Then we moved down to the next most costly, which is the sheep or goat. And again, it has to be a male without blemish. It has to be offered in basically the same way. Again, the entrails and legs are washed. Then the sacrifice is laid out onto the altar and is completely burned. Everything is consumed with the exception of the skin and the guts, and those are taken outside the camp and done away with. So that's the next costly. And then the least costly option of this, which is by the time you get to first century Israel, that's what most people are doing, is a dove or a pigeon. That's why you have pigeon sellers in the temple, because instead of bringing your own pigeon, you could go buy a pigeon. And so that's what's going on when Jesus turns over money tables. They're exacting too much of a charge for a pigeon, basically. They're making money off of the worshipers. So you could bring a dove, and the dove is spelled out there. And again, there's something that's held back, the crop. Not exactly sure what a crop is. I don't hunt. Is it like the gizzard? Is that what that is? The thing that... Okay, yeah. So it's like a chicken gizzard. That's what it is. Which basically, you eat chicken gizzards, you're eating chicken guts. So I can't imagine doing that. So that was taken out and thrown away, and then the rest of the bird was consumed. So that's the burnt offering. The burnt offering was, again, so major points about the burnt offering. The burnt offering was a voluntary offering. It was a when or when you bring it or if you bring it, not mandatory to bring it. The burnt offering symbolized the dedication, devotion of a worshiper to God, and it was done prescribed. There was burnt offerings had at the morning and the evening of every day, and at every feast day there was burnt offering at every first of every month there was burnt offering. Numbers 28 spells out burnt offering again in pretty much in a lot of detail. So if you want another reference for that, go to Numbers chapter 28 and you'll read about that. Yes, Amelia. Um, So that's a great question. She said, if it had to be from their own flock, did they raise doves? I don't think so, but you know, you can. Doves don't eat. They're not predators, carnivore, those kinds of things. You know, and I think there's a desire for God for even purity in the thing that's offered. So you could catch a dove rather easily. Although I do think they probably did raise doves for food. You know, in the wilderness, the quail deal, right? They ate quail. Quail's something that they would eat, and it may be that's kind of what's talking about here. It's a bird. So the answer is, well, yes and no. I think they did have some kind of birds, but it could easily be caught as well. I know that by the time you hit, you know, later on in Israel, they are, you know, there's a dove industry going on where they're raising and making doves just for the purpose of temple worship. So, and I think most people, that's probably what most people ended up bringing was a dove. And you could, if you didn't have anything like that, you could buy it. You could buy it to bring it. So you could do that. And again, this is not compulsory. This is voluntary. So you didn't have to do this. Although I think it became kind of a, you have to do this. If you really want to be really good, you really want to show devotion, you really want to be understood, but you need to do this. You know, it kind of became the thing. So I think by the time you get to Jesus' day, this voluntary had become somewhat compulsory. So anyway, that's the burnt offering. Good question. Anything else? Mike? Oh, yeah. By the time you get to even Amos, that's clearly on display. You have the rich who are really proud of their riches, and they're displaying that, and they're, you know, so I think any time you get something like this, there's going to be that kind of thing happening. I mean, you see that displayed even in the, you know, the way the Pharisees would put their money in the, you know, one coin at a time, jingle, 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 jingle type deal. So I'm sure that was going on with, oh, look at the Smithsteins. They are bringing, you know, I said Smithsteins. Look, they're bringing this great big bull. Wow, they're rich. They're quite a status family. So, yeah, I'm sure that happened. Yeah, Ron? Right.
And, but as time goes on, they're not supposed to become an aristocracy type of situation, but it became that way.
Right.
That's one point, but also, this wasn't something that they expected everybody to do.
Right. Right.
So this is something you do occasionally, not every day. Unless you're one of the head priests there, you probably do it a lot more often.
Yeah.
And another thing to note is that these sacrifices, as with the Passover sacrifice, for example, were killed not by the priest, but by the worshiper.
Okay.
So you actually had its blood on your own hands. The priest took over to do the splashing on the altar.
Okay.
Anything done on the altar was done by the priest, but the killing was done by the worshiper, and specifically on the north side of the altar,
right,
which in the case of the temple was a specific laid out area that had places to tie your animal.
Yep.
Laying on of hands. That's a major part. Mm-hmm. Or, so to speak.
Yeah. And it is interesting. It's only after that laying on of hands happened that that sacrifice was accepted by God. If you read it, it's the laying on, and then that sacrifice will be accepted. It's interesting. It was accepted before it was killed. It was accepted as the hands were laid on it. That's something that's there too. I should have looked at. Anyway, we're gonna keep moving. That's the burnt offering. All right. That's the burnt offering. Now we move to a grain offering. Move to a grain offering. This is the only offering that's all about grain. That's all about vegetables. Okay, this offering was this is another voluntary offering. The first three offerings are voluntary offerings. Grain offering was an offering that was designed to show their dedication, devotion, desire to please. It was designed to show to God through I think there's dependence there, because when you're bringing grain, you're bringing the very essence of what you need for life, right? And there's no blood associated with this offering. The grain offering has no blood associated with it. In any of its variations, there's no blood associated with the grain offering. There are three variations to the grain offering. The first variation is this. The first variation was fine flour. It was grain that you had harvested, that you had ground into fine flour. Fine flour would have no chaff with it whatsoever. It would not be whole wheat flour. It would be the fine grind ground flour that was very precious, and used for the finest of baking things. And you would bring that, and then it would get mingled with spices, mingled with oil, and then that would be offered as a grain offering. That's the first iteration. The second is you could bring bread. You could actually make bread at home and bring a loaf of that bread, but it had to be unleavened bread. It couldn't be bread with any kind of leaven in it, and there was a specific recipe, if you will, about the spices you would mix in with that you would bring that would be offered. And so the flour would be placed on the burnt on the altar and be burnt up. The bread, the loaf of bread you brought, would also be placed on the altar and burnt up. And the third iteration is you could bring grain, unground grain, just the corns of, or the kernels, I guess is what they're called, right? Kernels? The kernels of grain, you could bring that. No blood associated with the sacrifice. This is not a blood sacrifice. It was just to bring, and it was to show the heart of the worshiper that he was going to, he was giving himself in a way to be dedicated, to show his dependence upon God and God alone. And this was, again, a total consumed offering or sacrifice. This was to be completely consumed on the altar. So that's the grain offering, all right? Not one of the most glamorous offerings, or you're bringing grain. Next is the peace offering or fellowship offering. It's referred to two ways. It's found in chapter 3. Chapter 3, it's another voluntary offering. It's the one that you did not have to bring unless you wanted to. When we get to chapter 3, verse 1, it says, if his offering is a sacrifice of peace offering or a fellowship offering, again, he's going to offer, and this is an animal again. This is another animal that's going to be brought to the tent of meeting, and it's going to be burned again. It's hard to really get too much different detail. When this happened is when the person desired to come and bring this offering, and it was to symbolize the peace and the right relationship between the worshiper and God. It was to symbolize that. It's interesting, as these three really are kind of seen in concert, the three, the burnt, the grain, and the peace or the fellowship offering, were all kind of were all kind of seen in concert with each other. You would bring them to show your devotion and dedication, your dependence upon and your peace with, your reconciliation or right relationship with the God you're worshiping. That's what all three indicated. Yes, Steve. The peace, okay, great question. The peace offering could be female. The peace offering could be female. You didn't have to bring a male. The burnt offering had to be male. Had to be male, and it was symbolizing, done, you know, for to show my dedication and my devotion. The peace offering could be either male or female. It didn't have to be a male animal. It could be a female animal. And it, again, it was to show the right relationship of that worshiper. Yeah, go ahead.
Would the connotation be that the burnt offering is more of a sacrifice for sins, whereas the peace offering is just a thankfulness for your faith?
Yeah, that would be a good way to understand it. Yes. That would be what Steve said. Would the connotation be that the burnt offering is more regarding sin, and the peace offering or the fellowship offering more regarding, what did you say? Right relationship. Yeah, right relationship. Yes. I had it in my head. It just skipped right out of there. I knew I was going to say until I started saying it. And it was like, okay, blank. I don't know what I was going to say. So yeah, that's a good way to do it. And in the middle of there is the grain offering, which shows dependence. It's actually a neat picture that points to, and I think that's important, is as you're looking through this, you know, we don't do these sacrifices anymore. We don't do these anymore. In fact, we as Gentiles never did, right? But for all, Jesus accomplished these things. And I think it's interesting as you watch the progression of these three voluntary sacrifices. You see in the burnt offering the recognition of your devotion and your need, really, for someone to take your place. That's what's really displayed in the laying on of hands on that goat. Yeah, thank you. Goat, bull, whatever. Is I can't do this for myself. I'm putting mine on this thing, and it is in some sense substituting for me. Not good enough. When we get to Hebrews, we find that it's not good enough. It didn't cover it. But it does look to the need, and it looks to my devotion, to I am worshiping and I am totally in and totally dedicated to God. Then you have the grain offering, which is, and I can't do this myself, I depend on something else besides me. I cannot depend on myself for this. My dependence is completely upon God. And then you have the fellowship or the peace offering that says, and because of that, I am now right related to that God. So you see, even in the three voluntary offerings, I think you see a picture of the gospel in those three voluntary offerings. It's recognizing a need, recognizing dependence, and recognizing right relationship. And those three things, those three offerings really do point to really what Jesus came to do. It's also very interesting, and we're going to see it more when we get to the next two offerings, is where it says the unintentional. And you might say, well, I thought you said last week that these were unintentional sins. They are. If you read Hebrews chapter 9, we let the Bible talk about the Bible, let the Bible interpret the Bible. He says that in this way, the unintentional sins of Israel were atoned for, were covered. So there. This, again, doesn't cover the intentional sin. There was only one way for that to be taken care of, and that was really, it wasn't really taken care of. That happened on the Day of Atonement. And it didn't happen with the one that was killed. It happened with the scapegoat. The scapegoat is what, remember I told you about this last week, the scapegoat, the hands were laid on the scapegoat, and then the scapegoat was driven out. We know the scapegoat was killed. That wasn't originally the design or the intent, but the scapegoat was driven out. That was a picture of, and the only way for those to be taken was the picture of what Jesus was going to do. I would encourage you, as you read these sacrifices, then go read Hebrews chapter 9 and look at what God says about what these sacrifices really accomplished. Go ahead, Ron.
If you read anything from liberal scholars, they'll make the claim usually that in the Old Testament, through this part of the scripture, you see that's just absolutely correct.
Yep.
These are all sacrifices for individual sin.
Yep. Yeah, that's true. This is all an individual basis. This was not a, this is, you weren't coming to represent the nation. This wasn't done because the priest is somehow representing the nation. This is not it at all. We're going to get there. As you get to the sin and to the guilt offering, there is actually where there's a representative for the nation. There's a national, one of the delineations or the distinctions of how you do the sacrifice is exactly for if the congregation, if the whole congregation sins unintentionally, then this is how that's to be handled. There is a, in those, well, I'm getting ahead of myself. But yeah, these are, this is all on an individual basis. This is when a man, this is a person wants to or desires to bring this. This is all for an individual, not for the nation. This is not a national day. This is not a national sacrifice. This was an individual sacrifice by and on the desire and at the motivation of that individual. So yeah, that's an excellent point. This is not, this is, there is clearly a point to the individual relationship that every Joe Israelite had with God and could have with God. They were not cut off. Now, as far as approaching God, really hard to do. Really hard to approach God. You know, if you're outside the tabernacle, anybody could be there. Inside the tabernacle, only Jews. Inside the holy place, only priests. Inside the holy holies, only with the high priest, and only one day a year. So access to God was very limited, but worship of God was wide open, and for individuals as well. So how's that work? Well, worship is not necessarily access, especially in the Old Testament. Worship was done through a mediator, done through a priest, done through somebody who would represent you before the God's presence. Huh. Seems like that happened for us too, right? We can't approach God in our own selves. We only can approach God because there's one, a priest, who mediated for us and went before us. And in doing so, ripped the veil wide open and made access to God completely available for all who believe. So even his sacrifice, Jesus' sacrifice, accomplished exactly what was being accomplished here through the high priest and through the things that went on there. I think it's also important to say that these sacrifices, these offerings we're talking about, are in no way related to the Day of Atonement or any of the other feasts that are going on. These are daily sacrifices that happen on a daily basis, the first three completely voluntary, when and if the person wanted to bring them. Okay? So that's really important to note about those first three. What time is it? Let's see if we can get through these. The next is the sin offering. Starting in chapter 4, you have the sin offering. And I think I think it's important to read chapter 4, verse 1. It says, The Lord spoke to Moses, saying, speak to the people of Israel, saying, if anyone sins unintentionally in any of the Lord's commandments about the things not to be done, and does any one of them, and then he goes on to say, if it's a priest, if it's an anointed priest, here's what he has to do. If it is the congregation, if it's a willful sin on the part of the whole congregation, and we're going to see some of those, especially when we get the numbers, we're going to see some of those willful sins on the part of the whole congregation. We see willful, but we also see unintentional. This is unintentional, not willful. In fact, when we get to numbers, I think it's going to be a really good way to show some of the distinctions between that. For instance, there's going to be intentional sin when people come up against Moses and they try to overthrow him and go back, and God deals harshly with that. He doesn't give them a sacrifice to take care of it. He sends a curse on them. 140,000 people die in a day in numbers because they're really bad people, because they grumbled against Moses. Because they said, we're going to overthrow you, we're going to appoint somebody else, and we're going home. You should have just read it recently as you're reading through the Bible. If you're reading through the chronological thing we're doing, you just should have read about what Korah and Abijah and Dathan, those three that led this revolt. do the math, 140,000 people died that day because they aligned themselves with the wrong side. And that was a willful choice that they made. They didn't say, let's go do a sacrifice for that. No, there was devastation for that. Another time we're going to see a willful rejection of God is at Numbers 13 when they refused to go into the land. And that sealed their fate, It sealed their destiny. They didn't get to go in the land at all. It's funny, after they refuse, God says, I'm going to kill you, I'm not going to, and then Moses says, you can't do that. So they says, then they try to go in themselves, and that didn't work well for them because God wasn't with them in that. So I'm way off topic here. So the sin offering is for unintentional sin. And the first group listed for unintentional sin is a priest. The priest who sins. And he has a specific thing he's supposed to do in order to be atoned for, the atonement for his unintentional sin. How does somebody sin unintentionally? I think he describes it later on when he talks about if you sinned and didn't mean to do it, didn't know it, and it comes to your attention, then you are supposed to do something about it. I've thought about unintentional sin, and I'm not exactly positive how you get there, how you sin unintentionally. I'm just being honest. I don't know how you didn't know you told a lie. I don't know how you didn't know you killed somebody or didn't mean to. And it's not even the same thing as, like, you remember, because back in Exodus, there are rules for manslaughter or the unintentional killing of somebody. But violation of thou shalt not kill, murdering somebody, I don't know how that gets to be unintentional. I didn't know I killed you. I didn't mean to. I don't get that. I don't know. Now, I could see one of the big deals is, you know, moving your neighbor's property boundary. And I could see how maybe that could be an unintentional deal where you happen to kick the rock and didn't know it. I get that. But a lot of this unintentional sin, I'm not sure how it happens, but I'm still working on that one. And I've got like 3 weeks now to work on it and get back with you about unintentional. I'm just not confident I can really explain. So if you ask me, how do they do unintentional sin? I'm going to say, you know what? Good question. I don't know yet. He had his hand up first, and I'll get you. Go ahead. Okay.
And you can't get home, and you have to walk farther than you would have walked. It mentions specifically here sins of commission, not omission.
Right.
So it's things that you do that you shouldn't do that are related to the law, and they take it farther to mean the oral law as well as.
Okay. So what Ron said, it was like...
I feel like I'm the sinner type of thing.
Okay.
This is commission. And then you get down to the guilt offering, and it would be, oops, I touched a...
Yeah.
I touched a corpse.
Right. Good. Chris? Yeah, that's actually coming up. That it's actually in the prescription for the sin offering. He actually does start. He goes to and says, if you didn't know about a sin and it's brought to your attention or you figure it out, that's some of the unintentional. I get that what Ron said. I agree. Ron said that it's relation to some of the ritual like law, like being out caught in the field after the sun goes down and having to walk more and violate the Sabbath that way, when you didn't mean to violate the Sabbath, but you were put in a position where you had to. I get that, and I agree with that. The question is, how do you not know you told a lie? And maybe it's because you quoted somebody else and you realize, oh, that wasn't true. Well, then that's gossip. You shouldn't have done it in the first place. But so I'm working through that. I'm just saying that to say I'm working through that. And if your question is, how is a sin unintentional? I don't have a good answer for you yet on that one, but I'm still working on it. I'm confident there's a good answer. I just haven't figured it out for me yet. And I'm not gonna yank your chain or pull your leg and say, I think I got it, because I don't think I have it yet. But so we didn't get through the offerings. I thought we would. I actually had the next set of notes up here thinking I'm going to hand those out because we're going to get through this page. We didn't get through that page. We'll get through this page in like 3 weeks or so. Again, next week, Dave Hensling is going to be teaching. I'm going to be preaching. The week after that, Ray Sommer is going to be teaching because I'm coming back from Florida. And the week after that, Ron's going to be walking through the feasts of Israel with a point to how they show Christ. And then so I guess that means, because the next Sunday is Easter, right? April 8th, we'll go through this again. So it's. Let me pray, and then we'll let you get out of here. Lord, thank you for your love for us. Thank you for your grace, your mercy. Thank you for the picture of being right related to you through sacrifice, and thank you for sacrificing yourself on our behalf, providing us access to you. Thank you for loving us the way you do. We ask this in your name, amen. Great, you're dismissed. Go get your kids if you've got kids in the Sunday schools.